Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, an appeals court weighs arguments over access to the widely used abortion pill, mifepristone.
A deal allowing war-torn Ukraine to export grain is extended, alleviating fears of worsening food shortages, at least for now.
And Judy Woodruff visits her birthplace of Tulsa, Oklahoma, where a reckoning over historical racism echoes similar discussions nationwide.
We've tried to, over the last, I'd say, 20 years as a community, start having those conversations around race in our city that should have been happening for a century.
Good evening and welcome to the NewsHour. President Biden and congressional Republicans are giving fresh signals tonight that the deadlock over the debt ceiling may be easing.
Both sides voiced optimism today on striking a deal to avoid a national default, perhaps by this weekend. President Biden said he's confident that negotiators can agree to raise the current limit of $31 trillion before a June 1st deadline.
We're going to come together because there's no alternative. We have to do the right thing for the country. We have to move on. And to be clear, this negotiation is about the outlines of what the budget will look like, not about whether or not we're going to, in fact, pay our debts. The leaders have all agreed we will not default.
The president said he'll have more to say at a news conference Sunday after attending the G7 summit in Japan. In turn, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, backed by fellow Republicans, said a deal is doable by Sunday, but he also suggested the president should stay home.
He's the president of the United States. He's a grown man. He can make a decision where he wants to go, and he could travel any place he wants. The only thing I know, if you thought for the last 97 days you were never going to negotiate, what are your priorities? I think America wants us to solve American problems first.
Republicans are pressing for spending caps and work requirements for federal benefits in exchange for lifting the debt ceiling.
The president has now left for that overseas trip to Japan. He departed from Joint Base Andrews outside Washington late this morning. He'll join leaders of other major economies for the three-day summit in Hiroshima. The president canceled stops in Australia and Papua New Guinea so he can return to D.C. early for the debt limit negotiations. The U.S. Supreme Court is letting Illinois ban the sale of some semi-automatic guns and large-capacity magazines for now. The justices refused today to block the law pending a legal challenge. It bars sales of assault-style weapons like the AR-15. Those who already own such guns have to register them with police. In Pakistan, police have surrounded the home of former Prime Minister Imran Khan, raising new fears of unrest. He'd been arrested last week on corruption charges, then released amid violent protests. In Lahore tonight, police set up barricades outside Khan's home. They said he's sheltering supporters blamed for the violence, a charge he said is ridiculous.
If 40 terrorists are hiding at my residence, then it's a threat to my life, too. Please come, but not like this, to attack my house. Come like a civilized society with a search warrant. We will show you the whole house, and you'll see where these terrorists are.
Pakistani officials said police will raid Khan's home unless he hands over the suspects within 24 hours. Back in this country, Democrats in Pennsylvania still control the state house after winning a special election on Tuesday. The outcome has major implications for abortion and gun rights legislation. And in Kentucky, Republican Attorney General Daniel Cameron will challenge Democratic Governor Andy Beshear in the fall. Cameron was endorsed by former President Trump. On Wall Street, stocks rallied on hopes of a debt ceiling deal in Washington. Major indices were up more than 1%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 408 points to close at 33,420. The Nasdaq rose 157 points. The S&P 500 added nearly 49. And plebes at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, celebrated an annual rite of passage today, ending their first year. They worked together to scale the 21-foot Herndon Monument, slathered with grease for the occasion. When they finally reached the top, they replaced a freshman's cap with an upperclassman's. The slippery feat took just over 2.5 hours. Still to come on the NewsHour, new data shows a massive disparity in excess deaths among Black Americans compared to their white counterparts. Tulsa, Oklahoma, struggles to reconcile its troubling past with urban renewal. Comedian Leanne Morgan discusses her unusual road to success ahead of her new special, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Access to medication abortion faced a critical test today in the conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. A three-judge panel of Republican appointees heard arguments about whether the abortion pill mifepristone, first approved by the FDA more than 20 years ago, should stay on the market. It's the latest legal battle since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year. Joining us with reporting and analysis, Sarah Varney, a correspondent for KFF Health News, who's been reporting for the NewsHour about abortion access since the overturning of Roe, and Steve Vladeck, professor at the University of Texas School of Law and an expert on federal courts. His new book on the Supreme Court is The Shadow Docket. Thank you both for being with us. And Sarah, we'll start with you. Remind us why this case is so significant, said to be the most consequential since the overturning of Roe.
In the last number of years, the number of women who rely on medication abortion pills has grown to more than 50%. So access to this medication abortion regimen is incredibly important for women around the country. So when Judge Kaczmarek issued his decision in Texas before it was stayed, it essentially said that mifepristone would have to come off the market. So that would affect, of course, women who want to access abortion medication to terminate a pregnancy. It's also used a lot in early miscarriage management treatment. So that's something that physicians, OBGYNs around the country regularly turn to.
And Steve, the New Orleans-based Fifth Circuit is considered one of the most conservative appellate courts in the country. They have routinely ruled against the Biden DOJ. What lines of inquiry did the judges explore today, and what can you glean from it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk during today's argument about standing, this technical legal doctrine, which is basically asking, are these the right plaintiffs to be challenging the FDA's 2000 and subsequent approvals of mifepristone? I think what we heard from all three of the judges on the panel, all three of whom are Republican appointees, was real efforts to bolster, to support Judge Kaczmarek's analysis of why these doctors could challenge the FDA's actions. Jeff, even though in most of the, almost all of these contexts, the doctors are claiming an injury based upon something that may or may not happen in the future, which is that patients who have taken mifepristone will need some kind of emergency or urgent care, that's not usually enough for standing under the Supreme Court's precedents. Indeed, that kind of hostility to standing has been a staple of conservative jurisprudence for most of the last 50 years.
Yeah. And so this is likely going to head back to the Supreme Court. The fact that the court preserved access to mifepristone while this appeal was making its way through the system, what does that suggest?
Yeah, it's a little tricky because the Supreme Court's ruling from April had no analysis with it, so we don't know why a majority of the justices voted to keep Kaczmarek's ruling on hold. Jeff, we don't even know how many voted. We just know it was five or more. But I do think it's a pretty good sign that at least five of the justices are likely to reverse, to be unsympathetic to Judge Kaczmarek, whether because they don't think the plaintiffs have standing or because they're willing to side with the Biden administration on the merits. What's so important for now is that nothing the Fifth Circuit decides is going to affect the status quo. The stay the Supreme Court issued, preserving nationwide access, will remain in place until the Supreme Court acts, regardless of what the Court of Appeals does.
And Sarah, you've talked to abortion providers, women health experts, and advocates. How do they see this moment?
Well, I think that they're very relieved that mifepristone will remain on the market while this case plays out, which could take months, if not years, to reach the Supreme Court. You know, this is, as we were discussing, is just really about the stay of Judge Kaczmarek's order. So there's a whole other trial that can happen to sort of discuss the merits of this case. One of the things we actually heard from one of the judges today was, can we basically get the file from the FDA, the sort of full file going back to 2000? And the Justice Department has not been able to produce that yet. In part, she said, because this is a quarter century old and we have to go back into, she said, deep storage to literally pull out the entire file about mifepristone. So, you know, this case could take many, many months, if not years, to resolve itself.
Steve, on the specific question of safety, we know that mifepristone sends fewer people to the ER than Tylenol and Viagra. So if this case is successful, if the court effectively bans access to mifepristone, what does that mean for the FDA's regulatory authority over other drugs?
I mean, I think it means it's open season, and that we're going to see challenges, whether it's from the left, from the right, from, you know, the sort of anti-science part of the community, to a wide range of FDA approvals, both old ones and new ones, from over-the-counter medicines to vaccines to every kind of experimental treatment you can think of. In some respects, it'll be the Wild West. And I think that's part of why we saw the U.S. Supreme Court step in, not because the conservative justices are especially sympathetic to the nationwide availability of mifepristone, but because I think they can see, or at least some of them can see, the writing on the wall in a world in which 23 years after the FDA approves a medication, anyone can walk into a hand-picked federal courthouse and get a federal judge to second-guess that decision.
And when you say hand-picked federal courthouse, you mean the fact that this case was filed specifically in Texas, because they knew that it would end up before the specific appellate court.
That's right. So not just in Texas, but by filing in Amarillo, the Amarillo division of the Northern District of Texas, the plaintiffs, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, Jeff, they had a 100% chance of having the case be assigned to this specific judge, Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, who's pretty well known as an anti-abortion advocate before he went on the federal bench. You know, folks are going to have their own views about whether that's a healthy practice or not. When anyone can take advantage of that kind of manipulation of the trial court system, that's part of why this has such potentially cataclysmic implications for the entire universe of medication, of drug safety approval, because now you're going to see copycat lawsuits that have nothing to do with abortion, where you don't even have the same political valence, and where it's just everything that the FDA has done becomes open to challenge.
And Sarah, you've been following this since the very beginning. What are you watching for as this case unfolds?
Well, I think this question of standing is very interesting. I mean, I agree that it sounds like the justices at the court today were really trying to allow the anti-abortion groups to gain some credibility in their standing question. The other thing I thought was really interesting today was Judge James Ho, who's a Trump appointee. You know, he kept saying several times, it seems that your argument is that the FDA can do no wrong. And he recited several other drugs that had been removed from the marketplace. The Justice Department attorney came back and said, well, that was because the FDA went through a review process and removed the drug. But there did seem to be some hostility from Judge Ho about this idea that we should leave these decisions up to scientific and medical experts at the FDA. The other thing I thought was interesting was just this big question about doctors practicing medicine. And you saw several of the judges ask about, well, shouldn't doctors have to use an ultrasound? Shouldn't they have to see a patient in person? And the Justice Department would come back and say, you know, we asked doctors to practice medicine. In fact, you can ask a woman a lot of questions to determine whether or not she has an ectopic pregnancy, if there's referred pain in her shoulder, for instance, and that these things are very predictive of an ectopic pregnancy, or when was your last period. That can give us a real sense, of course, of how far along into a pregnancy is somebody. And you heard, I thought, from the judges, at least, this real interest in not believing doctors, not really trusting doctors to suss that out for themselves. So that's what I'll be looking for as well. Yeah.
You were shaking your head in agreement about the question of not trusting doctors.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Jeff, at the end of the day, the question is, who do we think is in a better position to measure, to weigh the medical, the scientific evidence? The folks at the FDA who are appointed by the president, who are given those positions because they have those qualifications, or federal judges, right? No one's really arguing that the government's actions are totally unreviewable. But when you have a system where a single federal judge anywhere in the country is in a position to just brush to the side 23 years of scientific medical evidence that the agency Congress has created to answer those questions has compiled, I think you see why this has potentially such enormous ramifications far beyond even the enormous mifepristone-specific ramifications of this one case.
Steve Vladeck and Sarah Varney, thank you both for your analysis and your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
A pair of new studies from the Journal of the American Medical Association find that the toll of racial disparities in health for Black Americans is even starker than we knew. That's true both in lives lost and an enormous economic cost as well. From 1999 to 2020, Black Americans experienced 1.63 million excess deaths compared to white Americans. This resulted in 80 million years of life lost. COVID widened that gap in deaths even further, and the loss was felt especially among infants and older adults. In terms of economic cost, the JAMA study found that in 2018, racial health inequities cost the U.S. an estimated $421 billion. Around two-thirds of that cost came from premature deaths. To explain the significance of this data, I'm joined by Dr. Lisa Cooper, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Equity and the Bloomberg Distinguished Professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Dr. Cooper, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
These numbers are absolutely staggering when laid out this way. You have long studied these issues. Were you surprised by these figures when you saw them?
Unfortunately, I wasn't surprised, although I have to say, though, I was disappointed because I was hoping that we would have seen some improvement over what we saw in the last century, and it seems like the trends are looking pretty much the same.
It is now well documented, the systemic racism that exists specifically in our healthcare system in America. How much of these numbers is attributable to that?
So I think it's important for us to note that structural racism is something that impacts all of our institutions. And so I think racism in healthcare contributes substantially to these statistics, but I think that racism throughout all of our institutions and throughout all of our policies is contributing to these disparities, because really those are the policies and practices that determine where people live, whether or not they have gainful employment, whether they can get a good education, whether they have access to healthy food and access to healthcare. So all of these things shape people's opportunities to live healthy lives and determine whether or not they die prematurely.
Dr. Cooper, these numbers are staggering when you look at them, but you still see a number of patients in your clinic. How do these numbers show up day to day in those patients?
Well, they show up in, you know, the young people I see. I see young adults, people as young as 30, 35, or 40 who already have hypertension, who already are obese, who already have had a stroke. I see people who are in middle age who have diabetes and have suffered amputations and can no longer work. And a lot of these people are, you know, from communities that have low income, or they are, you know, African Americans, people who are Hispanics. I see people at very young ages with diseases that normally you would see in older people. So, you know, it's painful and it's hard to see. And there are a few people that actually beat the odds, but the odds are definitely not stacked in their favor.
There is an economic component to this study as well. As we mentioned, the hundreds of billions of dollars in cost of those racial health inequities. Why, to you, is that an important part of this this argument?
Well, I think it's an important part because I think, you know, in lots of ways, our economy and our businesses, they respond to things like this. I think people don't realize the interconnection between health and productivity. Oftentimes they see them as separate things. And if we can see that it's that our health is connected to everything we do, we cannot work, we cannot innovate, we cannot compete successfully with other countries if we have poor health. And if we have poor health in certain groups of people in our country, that actually puts our entire country at a disadvantage. So I think it's important for people to understand the scope of the problem, that it's human suffering, and it impacts society in so many, many different ways, but economically is something that a lot of people really understand.
So Dr. Cooper, what does it take to turn these numbers around?
Well, it's going to take a lot of work, but I think that one thing we need to do is to understand that we actually have science to inform a lot of the solutions. And what we need to do is to use what we know. As we generate more information and more science, we need to use what we know already. We know that early childhood education improves health later in life. So we should support policies and practices that do that. We know a higher living wage, higher income or minimum wage will improve economic opportunities and the health of people in their adulthood. We know that changing the life circumstances, the living conditions in neighborhoods and housing quality and access to food, we know all those things work to shape health. And we know that providing universal access to healthcare improves healthcare outcomes, and especially for those who can't afford it based on, you know, who they work for. So we just know a lot that we aren't implementing because we need to generate stronger political will. And doing that means engaging with people in communities that are impacted by health disparities and making sure that they are civically engaged and that they have, you know, the know-how and the involvement and the input at the decision-making tables. And I think in so doing, we will, you know, we will achieve the goal, but it's something that everyone needs to understand that it impacts us all.
That is Dr. Lisa Cooper, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Equity, joining us tonight. Dr. Cooper, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Today, Russia agreed to extend a deal that allows Ukraine to export grain to the rest of the world. The agreement between Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, and the U.S. is a lifeline in a moment of global food insecurity. Nick Schifrin is following these developments and joins us now. So, Nick, how did this grain deal extension come about? And I should say, I said it involved the U.S. I should have said the U.N.
No, absolutely. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced that Russia had decided unilaterally to extend this deal by 60 days. And as you said, UN, as well as Turkish negotiators, had really been trying to negotiate furiously ahead of tomorrow's deadline to get Russia to do a longer extension. Moscow's been asking for concessions, claiming that this deal doesn't allow it to sell its own grain and its fertilizer to the rest of the world, something the U.S., by the way, denies. But even only at 60 days, Jeff, as you know, this deal is so vital. Ukraine has historically been a breadbasket for the world, especially when it comes to corn and grain. Some 345 million people around the world are food insecure, and access to this Ukrainian grain really can help prevent hunger, even famine, especially in the Horn of Africa.
So this grain deal, as you said, it's a rare agreement as the war continues. We know that Russia in recent days, they've stepped up their missile attacks. How is Ukraine dealing with that, confronting it?
Yeah, it's an incredible stepping up by Russia because of how they're trying to attack Kyiv and Ukraine's critical infrastructure. They have been using the Kinjal. That is one of its most advanced weapons. That is a hypersonic weapon. It was unveiled about 5 years ago by Russian President Vladimir Putin in great fanfare. He said that it could fly Mach 10, which means 10 times the speed of sound. It would be launched from Russian jets, as you're seeing. This is Russian Defense Ministry video right there. Putin called that weapon that you're seeing right there, quote, invincible. And the assumption was that it could avoid air defense. But it turns out that it is very vulnerable to an air defense system called the U.S. Patriot, which the U.S. has only recently delivered to Ukraine. A defense official confirms to me that one of the Kinjals did do some light damage to a Patriot missile, but the Patriots were able to shoot down about half a dozen hypersonics. And I asked David Wright of MIT, who explained that the reason the Patriot was able to shoot the Kinzhal down is actually less about the Patriot and more about the Kinzhal itself.
What people tend to forget is that the high speeds, Mach 10, is really the maximum, the top speed that they reach, and that they slow down as they re-enter the atmosphere. So as they dive toward their target, they hit very thick atmosphere, and the drag tends to slow them down. And by the time they get to low altitudes, they're going slow enough that I had actually predicted that a Patriot might be able to shoot them down. And it appears that Ukraine has shown that now.
And if that's the science, the reason this is important for Ukraine, it's proven that Russia, with even its most advanced missiles, cannot be guaranteed to hit Kyiv's critical infrastructure. And that's incredibly important both for the country, but also ahead of this counteroffensive that we're expecting. The U.S. officials tell me has begun in earnest with what are called shaping operations, mostly attacks inside occupied territory, including with a long-range British missile called the Storm Shadow that's just been delivered. In the coming weeks, Jeff, we expect barrages of artillery from Ukraine to begin ahead of a ground offensive with newly arrived Western weapons and training.
Meantime, Nick, President Biden left today for the G7 gathering in Japan, but because of the debt ceiling negotiations, he canceled visits to Australia and what would have been the first ever visit by a sitting president to Papua New Guinea. What's been the reaction to that?
Officially understanding. The Australian Prime Minister today said he understood why President Biden had to cancel. And last night, the White House hosted ambassadors from Pacific countries, and it was described to me that the room responded with understanding as well. But remember why the visit, especially to Papua New Guinea, was going to be so important. The U.S. has been trying to expand its footprint in the Pacific beyond its two huge bases to a handful of locations. And you see the location of Papua New Guinea there off the coast of Australia. In order to complicate Chinese war planning really across the region. And during the visit, President Biden was expected to sign with Papua New Guinea's prime minister a defense cooperation agreement that would have eventually gotten U.S. troops stationed in Papua New Guinea and around Papua New Guinea. Now, White House and regional officials say that agreement is not in peril. But Jeff, as you know, remember what the White House argues, that democracies can deliver, the U.S. can deliver despite domestic political dysfunction. And what China will argue is that, no, U.S. domestic politics can interfere with U.S. commitment to the region, according to Zach Cooper of the American Enterprise Institute.
What leaders in Asia are looking for is the United States to be a reliable partner, and that means showing up sometimes, even when we have domestic challenges. And I think there'll be a lot of questions about, you know, look, the debt ceiling, we knew roughly when it was going to be a problem. And so why did we schedule a whole series of meetings when we knew that these negotiations were going to go up to the last minute? And alternatively, if, as the president said today, they have agreed that they're not going to default, then why can't the president stay in Asia?
The U.S. officials are trying to get Secretary of State Antony Blinken there. But bottom line, Jeff, the U.S. and China will continue their competition for the region.
Got it. Nick, we should acknowledge that starting this week, you are taking some time off for paternity leave.
I am.
You will be
to it.
Dearly missed. But we wish you and Camilla and your growing family all the best.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Fantastic.
Over the past few years, as the country's been reckoning with questions of race, justice, and equality, many state legislatures have passed laws restricting how American history, particularly institutional racism and its legacy today, can be taught in public schools. Tonight, Judy Woodruff visits her native Tulsa, Oklahoma, to try to understand how that city, amid its own reckoning, is navigating this moment. It's her latest installment of America at a Crossroads.
This is where the Dreamland Theater was located. And my great aunt Janie, when she was 17 years old, she went on a date. Who would have known that during this date, the massacre happened?
Community activist Christy Williams is a descendant of Janie Edwards, who was just a teenager in Tulsa more than 100 years ago, when she snuck out one Saturday night for a date and found herself fleeing for her life.
She remembered that there were gunshots flying everywhere, there was fire everywhere, and she said they dropped bombs, and you could smell the fire and the smoke from miles and miles away.
The day before, a young black man working as a shoe shiner was arrested for allegedly assaulting a white woman on an elevator. A confrontation at the courthouse followed, and on the morning of June 1, 1921, a mob of white men chased a group of black men into Greenwood, a 35-block district of black-owned businesses and homes known as Black Wall Street, killing an untold number of residents and burning their community to the ground. Yet the stories of what happened in Tulsa that weekend were for a long time buried in fear, intimidation, and shame.
They didn't want to repeat it because they always feared that if they talked about it around the people who did it, who were looting the homes and burning the homes and killing people, so you didn't want that to happen again. So you kept quiet about it.
For decades, other stories about Tulsa have been told, a place once known as the oil capital of the world, but more recently home to new residents drawn by an affordable cost of living and a transforming downtown, rich in music, history, and culture, including Greenwood. In fact, my own story began here. I was born and spent the early years of my life in this, the second largest city in Oklahoma.
I only lived in Tulsa for 5 years, but I came back often to visit family, especially my grandmother, who lived in this house in North Tulsa. I never remember hearing anything about Greenwood until news reports began to circulate a few years ago.
We're sitting right sort of at the epicenter of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, arguably the worst incident of urban racial violence in American history. And it was not discussed openly for nearly 75, 80 years. So this represents the evolution of Tulsa's really racial history.
Tulsa's mayor, G.T. Bynum, comes from a long line of Tulsans, as well as former city mayors on both sides of his family.
And the goal, of course, at the very top is reconciliation for us as a community.
In 2021, he apologized for the city's failure to protect black Tulsans 100 years earlier and from decades of discrimination after.
I think the greatest change I've seen in my lifetime, and especially just in the last 5 to 7 years, is the openness with which racial disparities are discussed in our city. And we've tried to, over the last, I'd say, 20 years as a community, start having those conversations around race in our city that should have been happening for a century, but we've tried to compact all of that into the last 20 years and really in earnest into the last decade.
Historians estimate that 300 people may have been killed in the massacre. In 2018, Mayor Bynum announced an effort to find out more using ground-penetrating radar, coring, and excavation to explore 4 sites where victims of the massacre may have been buried. Just recently, a team announced that they had sequenced DNA from 6 sets of human remains exhumed from Oaklawn Cemetery and are now seeking the public's help in identifying them.
It's an opportunity for us to make Tulsa the kind of city that I think this generation of Tulsans wants it to be. We want to be a city where when horrible things happen to people, we as a city rally around them and do our best to find out what happened and be there for their families and their descendants. At the same time, there's a human challenge. There's a great lack of trust towards the city because the city didn't do enough for so long.
The question that I have and the question that so many North Tulsans have is, what are you going to actually do about it?
These are abandoned homes, and you see this throughout my district.
City Councilor Vanessa Hall Harper, who represents Tulsa's 1st District in the North, recently gave me a tour of her district where many black Tulsans live today.
And so you have a lot of vacant houses and vacant lots.
Following the carnage of the massacre, many Greenwood buildings and businesses were rebuilt. But in the decades that followed, developers built a highway through the heart of Greenwood, which, combined with housing discrimination in the form of race-restrictive covenants and redlining, drove many residents north.
This was the only part of town that black people could live.
Today, Hall Harper says her district suffers from poor housing, health care, nutrition, and employment. And a 2015 Tulsa Health Department report found a greater than 10-year difference in the lifespan of those living in a zip code in the north versus just a few miles away in South Tulsa.
The community living in North Tulsa is largely African-American, black, brown, and poor people. And South Tulsa is largely white affluent. That's a problem. And that's not only a problem for North Tulsans, that's a problem for a city.
She campaigned on a promise to address the food deserts in her community.
There's nothing in discount dollar stores that's healthy.
And in 2021, with support from Mayor Bynum, she helped deliver fresh fruits, vegetables, and dairy in the Oasis Fresh Market. But she says a lot more needs to be done to make this community whole.
You know, I grew up, when I had to apologize, I had to do more than just say I'm sorry. I had to do all that I could do to make right what I had done.
She's currently helping to lead a series of community conversations called Beyond Apology to try to engage residents over what more the city should do, including on the question of reparations.
So when you speak of reparations, what do you mean exactly by that?
think we are in the process right now of having those conversations beyond apology. But if you're asking me, Vanessa Hall Harper, reparations to me is land and cash.
To whom?
To everyone that was involved, to the not only the victims, but to their descendants. But not only were individuals destroyed, community was destroyed. This entire space, this entire area was impacted. And so what does that form of reparations look like? I think those are conversations that we must have.
Mayor G.T. Bynum.
We need to do right by Tulsans who were murdered in 1921. That's why we are doing this search for the graves. We've allocated over $1 million in city funds that has been unanimously supported by the city council and overwhelmingly supported by the public. Public has overwhelmingly supported our work around economic development. One could view all of that work as reparations. There are others who say you've got to levy a property tax on everyone who lives in Tulsa and issue cash payments. That to me is a much more challenging question because you're financially penalizing everyone who lives in Tulsa today for something that criminals did 100 years ago. But we're going through a dialogue, and the way I think you address it is to keep the dialogue going.
And yet, Republican state lawmakers have arguably made that harder.
More fallout from the signing of House Bill 1775 in Oklahoma.
In 2021, despite opposition from school boards and public universities across the state, Governor Kevin Stitt signed House Bill 1775, legislation restricting how history can be taught in public schools.
And as governor, I firmly believe that not 1 cent of taxpayer money should be used to define and divide young Oklahomans about their race or sex.
On its face, 1775 is about preventing discrimination on the basis of race or sex, but it includes a provision that says no individual should feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any form of psychological distress on account of his or her race or sex, which some worry is so broad and subjective that it's having a chilling effect on the teaching of difficult subjects like the 1921 massacre.
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's totally ridiculous that you don't teach history of what actually happened just for fear of making someone feel guilty. Teach them also, in order for this not to happen, these are the things that we must do.
Well, Tulsa Public Schools is the first district in Oklahoma accused of violating a new state law that regulates how districts teach about race and gender.
The law is already having real-world consequences. Last summer, the accreditation ratings of two Oklahoma school districts, Tulsa and Mustang, were downgraded. In Tulsa, because teachers took part in an implicit bias training.
House Bill 1775 was created for this purpose, to create accountability and transparency.
Tulsa area resident Janice Danforth spoke in favor of the downgrading at the July state board meeting in Oklahoma City.
I ask you today to follow through and let TPS be the example across Oklahoma that breaking the law is not only unacceptable, it's illegal, and as a district, you will pay the price for that decision.
A mother of two boys, one in public school, one in private, in 2021, Danforth founded the Tulsa chapter of Moms for Liberty, a nonprofit parents' rights group started in Florida during the pandemic that has now spread across the country. The group is officially nonpartisan, but aligns itself with conservative causes. Danforth says Tulsa Public Schools, which for years have struggled with low funding and test scores, need to focus on academics.
And that should really be the only thing they're focusing on and not diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Are you saying that it's wrong for teachers to be conscious of diversity?
Not at all.
Then what's the argument then?
Well, critical race theory, or if you want to look at diversity, equity, inclusion, equity is making everyone equal. That's not the case, right? We can't all have the same thing. That is Marxism, literally. We want equitable, not equity, where everyone has the same opportunity.
I asked Danforth how teachers are supposed to manage how a student feels about a historical event like the 1921 massacre without worrying about hurting their district's accreditation or jeopardizing their teaching licenses.
How do you carefully make that separation, though?
I think you can show that there were some people in that time frame that were not good people. They had Ku Klux Klan was a terrible organization that did terrible things to Black people. And I think kids can learn about it without having to have that concept put on them like it's their fault.
And you think teachers are able to make that distinction, should be able to make that distinction?
Absolutely. I think if you're worried about how you're teaching it, then you're probably teaching it wrong.
I would not want any student in Tulsa taught that they're lesser than someone else because of their race. At the same time, there are legitimate concerns around making sure that we do have difficult conversations and that we learn about difficult history.
For his part, Mayor Bynum, a Republican, says if in fact the new state law is preventing the teaching of history like the events of 1921, legislators should amend it.
We're home to the consequences of not talking about difficult history for three quarters of a century right here in Tulsa, where the city fathers after 1921 decided we're not going to talk about this race massacre because it's such an embarrassment. And so now it's left to this generation of Tulsans to try and catch up on all that and investigate it 100 years after the fact, which is really challenging.
Also want to keep educating ourselves and our own. That's really important. So
community activist Christy Williams isn't waiting for the legislature to act. She recently started her own program, Black History Saturdays, for young people, their parents, and local teachers to meet once a month to learn in an environment free from the fear of saying the wrong thing.
You know, history and learning is uncomfortable. But if you understand someone else's history, then you won't treat them like they're an outcast. If you were taught that all I was is a slave, my people were just slaves, you don't see that much in me. So, I mean, it's a benefit for all people to learn Black history.
A community that remains divided over its past and how to move forward, but still trying to engage. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Judy Woodruff in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And take a look online where Judy shares her personal reflections on reporting on Tulsa. That's at pbs.org/newshour.
Leanne Morgan finds comedy in the chaos of marriage and motherhood. She's a storyteller who draws from her experiences growing up in rural Tennessee, being married for over 30 years, raising three kids, and becoming a grandmother for the first time.
When my boy and his wife found out about this precious baby, they would say, their baby. And we would say, our baby. And then they started using words like boundaries.
Now at 57 years old, Leanne Morgan's stand-up career is taking off. And she's just released her first Netflix stand-up special.
They're going to have this precious baby, and they're going to be up all night, and that's going to go into weeks and months, and then my little daughter-in-law is going to start hallucinating. And then she's going to wake up in the night, and she'll be breastfeeding a lamp. And we'll see who's got boundaries.
I sat down with her in New York City to talk about her unconventional comedy career.
Most comedians get their starts in comedy clubs or in writers' rooms. You found your way to professional stand-up by selling jewelry, is that right?
Yes, my darling. Okay, so my husband and I met at the University of Tennessee. Uh-huh. And when we graduated, he bought a used mobile home business where he refurbished mobile homes and sold them. And he moved me to Bean Station, Tennessee, in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, and I start selling jewelry.
And you're going house to house doing this.
I'm going house to house at night. My husband took care of the baby. And then I was supposed to be talking about jewelry, and I'd schlepped this big jewelry case around. And I didn't talk about jewelry. I talked about breastfeeding and hemorrhoids. And I developed a shtick, really, an act. And women thought I was funny and started booking me about a year in advance.
Wow.
And that gave me the confidence. People would say, you need to be a stand-up.
Is that what you wanted for yourself? Did you want to be a stand-up comedian?
I wanted to be in show business, and I thought I was funny. I always loved comedy, but I didn't know what it would end up. But stand up, I knew I could tell a story.
Ladies and gentlemen, Leanne Morgan!
After two decades on stage, Leanne's first special on YouTube has more than 50 million views. Her new Netflix special reached the top 10.
My husband and I met, and I was so cute. And I was little, I had on little britches, and my thyroid was functioning. And now, I truly believe he would not pull me out of a burning vehicle.
Your family provides fodder for so much of your act. How do they feel about that?
They feel fine about it now. Mm-hmm. When they were in middle school, my children said, do not speak my name. And they also said, don't come up to this school with yoga pants on. So that was a dry time for me. And my husband only one time has said to me, don't say that again. I said something about I wanted something, but it was a bad mobile home year. Uh-huh. And he said, I've always provided for you. Do not say that again. And it hurt me for him. And I've never said anything like that again. But he doesn't care about anything else. And in my twisted mind, I think, oh, I can lose 40 pounds in 4 weeks.
Leanne's act is relatable and a reflection of her life. Comedy with a common touch.
I've done every diet in the world. My mama and my sister and I took Dexatrim. Do y'all remember Dexatrim? Yeah. It was speed. We took speed as a family. They sold it on the shelves everywhere. We were all taking dope. I mean, that's funny how things resonate with people, because I've had more comments of people saying, oh my gosh, my mom and I took Dexatrim together. Yeah. My mama gave it to us, and I was this big around, you know, and I was raised on by farming people and out in the middle of, we knew where our beef was coming from. I was tiny, and then taking diet pills on top of that. I would now, but I think my heart would flutter.
Right, right.
I'm out here on the porch. And I'm looking rough.
When COVID hit, Leanne was about to start a 100-city tour. And like many others, leaned into social media and cooking.
You just mix all that together and you just chill it. And it's really good. I started talking about my recipes and taking care of my little mom and daddy. They needed me. And what I was feeding them and my family. And it grew more than I ever thought it would. So that was a helpful thing. As horrible as all that was, I think it helped grow my audience, because people were at home and...
Yeah, and they gave them a point of connection.
And people started making all this Jell-O all over the United States, and I know Jell-O is very divisive.
It's controversial. That's
it's
right.
Very controversial. But where I'm from in the Middle Tennessee, we love a good gelatin salad, you know, with a little pineapple, a pecan, little cottage cheese or cream cheese, little Cool Whip.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know,
that's way
Jeff.
Beyond.
I know.
That's you beyond look, the Jell-O.
I know.
I'm used to.
I don't want to worry you, but to us, that's a big, it's nice to take to a church supper.
The thing I really loved about your act is that there's no underlying political or social message. It really is just about the laughs. It's about finding the funny moments in family and growing older.
And I understand how people want to do that and do the comedy that way, but I just never written that way or ever thought that way. Plus, I thought nobody cares what I think, and I don't. I want it to be fun. I don't want anybody to feel uncomfortable. But that's how I don't write that way. I probably don't read enough, Jeff, to know what's going on.
Leanne says this run of success could not have happened at a better time. She just signed on to star in a Will Ferrell and Reese Witherspoon comedy. And she's back on the road on a national stand-up tour this summer.
The tour is called Just Getting Started. Is that how it feels?
Yes, Jeff. Okay, when you're from the country like I am, you know, we're meemaws. We like to start cooking pinto beans and wearing house dresses.
Right.
And I thought, I'm just going to bow out of this thing. And then this happened.
Yeah.
When I look back on it, because I've had television deals for sitcoms. Mm-hmm. I've had 4 deals. And they wouldn't make it. My children were little. And I'd be devastated. And I look back on it now and I think, oh my gosh, that was not the right time. I got to raise these children in Knoxville, Tennessee. And then now, they don't need me like they used to. They still need me.
Mm-hmm.
And then this happened to me at this time in my life.
Yeah.
And I'm having a ball. I'm having a ball. And it's bigger and more wonderful and more special than anything I ever dreamed of.
I love that she says your name with 2 syllables. GF, was that a trip? Were you just laughing the whole
time?
Isn't
she the best? And I got to say, as part of her tour, she sold out the Grand Ole Opry, which is a big deal for anybody, but certainly somebody from Tennessee.
Good for her.
Yeah, she's something else. And that interview was part of our arts and culture series, Canvas. Meantime, May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and our student reporting labs is exploring how food is tied to culture and identity.
In Hillsboro, Oregon, student reporter Sandeep Rajesh Pillai of the Beaverton Academy of Science and Engineering has this story of a Cambodian refugee whose restaurant helps him heal from a tragic family history and provides a space to share his culture.
I dreamt about it, and now I'm living it. It's easy for me because this is what I wanted. My name is Saran Koot. I was born in Cambodia in 1970, and I came to the United States when I was 10 years old in 1981. When the communist rebels took over Cambodia in 1975, anything with knowledge and intellectual stuff, they don't want it anymore. They want to reset the country back to the year zero. My father was a well-known person in our community, in our town. He was a teacher. When the Khmer Rouge took over in 1975, he couldn't hide his identity. And so they took him away one night, in the middle of the night, and they took him outside of town, and they beat him to death. When we were there, we were moved from town to towns. My mother was put to work in work camps, and my sister and I were orphaned for several months. I was the one that had to look for ways to feed my sisters and myself and my grandmother. We were suffering a lot, but fortunately we made it. My wife and I, we wanted a venue where we can host a lot of people for events and stuff like that. And so we built this together with our own hands, pretty much. I feel really good about what we do here. And my goal was to get closer to my community, to be more connected, to have a better networking system. You know, we serve foods, but it's also more than just food here at Mekong. We build relationship, we create good memories. I want to do more to help bring lights to what happened there in Cambodia, and also I want people to not forget about the genocide. Cambodia has been underrepresented. Cambodia is more than just the killing field. Cambodia is a country full of rich culture, arts, foods, and entertainment, and everything else. And so I wanted to at least shed some light on Cambodia and the Cambodian culture.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.